In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
C-R-I-M-E-W-A-V. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit. Right now, I'm going to turn it over to J.P. White, and you can get more from him at his website, jpwhite.net.
My name is J.P. White, and I'll be reading from my debut novel, Every Boat Turns South. It's the story of Matt Younger, a 30-year-old delivery boat captain, who returns to Florida to make a confession to his dying father. Matt wants to tell his father, whose name is Skip, about a failed boat delivery on a 40-foot trimaran called Stardust from West Palm Beach to St. Thomas. But his father wants to hear about Matt's role in the death of the favorite son, Hale Younger. Chapter 5 begins in Florida, then returns to South Caicos in the Bahamas, where Matt decides with crew member Philip LaForgue to cross a body of water at night between the Bahamas and the Caribbean called the Thorny Path. Matt has just stolen $2 million worth of cocaine from a drug pilot named Jimmy Q. The trade winds are against them. A storm finds them. A former crew member named Jesse Dove has betrayed them. St. Thomas is a long way off. Chapter 5, From Every Boat Turns South, available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble online. Night comes with a thunder bang, light skitter, and rain flooding gutters. Skip looks like a man laid out on a slab with no more secrets, his head thrown back, spit on his chin, his cotton blanket askew. I want my father to know who I am. I'd love it if he'd look me in the eye with something other than confusion or disappointment. But even that I don't need. I just want him to listen to my tale and tell me I'm not an unwanted ghost scraped off the ocean floor. That's all. No hugs, no handshakes, no winks, no tender mercies, no fare-thee-wells. Just hear me out. In my exhaustion and relief to motor back into Cockburn Harbor, I almost don't hear the grunting coming from below decks. Philip has brought a local on board, and the two of them tear up the floorboards with their lust. After 15 hours of clutching $2 million in cocaine, I never expect to return to a boarded-up love boat. I try to stomp my feet, but they're too sore. I want to wrap my knuckles on the cabin top, but my hands are a pulpy mess. Instead, I grab a screwdriver from the stern lazarette and tap on the companionway slats. In his own sweet time, Philip and another man emerge from below, half-dressed and painted with a sweat sheen. You look terrible, Philip says, and in the same breath, Matt Younger, I'd like you to meet Jeremy Higgs. Like most Bahamian men, Jeremy wears pants instead of shorts. His red pants, black belt, and a matching red T-shirt stand out in stark contrast to his plum-tinted black skin. I lean down to Philip as Jeremy ambles toward the bow. We're shipping out now, I say, turning away from Jeremy. For where? St. Thomas. Against the trades? To hell with the trades, I say, pointing with my mangled right tennis shoe at the swollen backpack. You found it? Philip asks. You in? I reply, looking at my hands shaking. I'll give you half of what this stuff is worth if you see stardust across the thorny path. I see in Philip's squinted eyes the tiny wheels of hesitation breaking. I need you, I add. I can't sail this rig alone. It'll be ugly if we get caught, Philip advises. In the DR, they shoot you for possession. In Puerto Rico, we'll get sentenced according to U.S. law. In St. Thomas, we'll get swallowed by the Brits. If Jimmy catches up with us, the sharks won't even be able to find us. Not to mention we're now stealing Sam's boat. Remember we got fired from this gig? Wells will come around, I say. I'll call him from St. Thomas. He'll be thrilled we arrived. And Jimmy Q? This is penny ante stuff for him. He's not going to care about it. We're not going to get caught, I say, softly, as I watch Jeremy at the bow cupping a cigarette from the wind, probably thinking we're fighting over him. Believe me, I continue, the hard part's over. We're going to be very rich very soon. I tell Jeremy to get in his skiff. He looks hurt, jilted, peeved. I shrug and shove him off. It's crazy. It's dangerous, Philip says. But why not? I guess I'm more than ready to leave this place now that I've got my good luck charm. What's that? I ask, forgetting everything else that's already happened in South Caicos. My pink pearl. He cups the large pearl in his palm for me to see again. She's a beauty, all right, I say, digging out a spare anchor so I can leave the stolen Boston whaler behind. Are we taking a shortcut to Davy Jones' locker? Philip asks, now quickly dressing. What's going to stop us now? I ask. How about that wind blowing straight away from Africa at about 25 knots? Fuck the wind, I say. By the way, Philip says, we're missing our extra set of engine keys. They won't do Jesse any good in Florida, I say, watching a train of clouds scudding over the thorny path. I need an hour to stow the cocaine in a forward compartment inside the starboard hull. I take each sealed bag, wrap it in aluminum foil, and hide them all inside a panel tightened down with four hefty screws. Philip prowls the engine, checking oil, injectors, fuel line, batteries. We each take on necessary jobs with the speed and efficiency of the hunted. After each completed task, we give the thumbs-up sign and move on to the next. Around 11 p.m., we weigh anchor. The only other boat in the harbor besides the rusting freighter is a 60-foot cruiser named Citadel. I see her lights showing. I hear the low growl of her diesels. She's a fancy craft for such a remote harbor. I hope her crew thinks I'm headed toward Provo to the north rather than foolishly south. We slip out of Cockburn Harbor with the wind freshening to 30 knots out of the southeast. On a 103-degree heading, I aim to round the tip of the DR and make good for Puerto Rico, 300 miles to the southeast. Every mile of this heading running straight into the crooked teeth of the southeast trades. Stardust handles the two-hour windward leg to Sault Key with surprising finesse. Our big trimaran flies into the darkness like a three-hulled dragonfly born of some ancient earthly violence. More wind, more waves breaking with their heads torn off, more darkness flashing like the swish of a long tail. The night terrifies me, and that terror tells me Jimmy's hellhounds have been unleashed. I can't see them, but I can hear their panting. Once below Grand Turk, the seas run at us from the southeast and throw down a black inky sheen, backlit by the moon. Let's reef this puppy down and fall off, Philip shouts below, where I wedge myself against the navigation table, working out alternative headings in case we get knocked down. I jump topside as Philip brings Stardust into the wind. The jib whips against itself. The boat heaves in the groundswell like a panting beast. Oncoming waves crash through her bow netting and break in giant sheets on the foredeck. I lower the mainsail on the hoist and hurry to secure the first set of jiffy reef lines to the boom. Easy 20-footers, I yell into the spray of a breaking wave. This is going to be one hell of a ride. I start to sing one of your rhymes, Skip, that you always sing when the gray teeth of the sea turn white.
Hold her down, McCarty cried. Stop her, said McGew. The devil's in the wheels behind. It's over the road we flew.
Skip stirs, kicks at his sheets, and looks at me, flummoxed, seemingly, not so much by my story as by the fact he's not in this storm. When are you going to make good with your mother and tell her where you've been? He asks, looking at the unmoving fan overhead. I wish you would tell your brother I want to talk. We have some catching up to do. Skip returns to his zone of unmeasured fog, half listening, half sleeping like a bellbuoy tethered to a chain at the mouth of a river with no name. As I finish tying the last reef point on the main, a rogue wave rides underneath and whips stardust sideways. I lose footing, skid on one knee across the cabin top, catch myself at the lifelines, and claw back to the cockpit. By 1:30, stardust stalls in steep chop. To go below is a cruel, taxing punishment. The flexing of the fiberglass in the forward berth sounds like the ripping of tinfoil. With each rise and reverberating plunge, it feels, Skip, like stardust will topple over the Earth's edge and somersault into some other more distant ocean no man or God has ever known. And I'll deserve my fate without a last glimpse of the great perhaps. No way we can hold this course, I shout to Philip, who leans against the cabin. We've got to head for the DR. That's where they shoot druggies first, hold the trial later, Philip calls out. We don't have a choice, I say. She simply can't take these seas. I'll get us a new heading. I'd rather take our chances out here, Philip mutters when he takes the wheel, and I go below to seek the thin blue light of the navigation table. The once Bristol fashion stardust is now in shambles. Nearly every stowed book, chart, pencil, and cup lies scattered over the cabin sole. A netting of fruit is broken loose from its eye hook. A smashed banana clings to the cabin top. I sweep off the debris and spread out my chart of the Caicos Islands and the adjacent passages, and combine it with a chart covering Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Puerto Rico. I step off with the dividers the distance we've come, based on time and speed. I put us roughly 60 miles off the DR, or a little over halfway across the thorny path. If we lay off another 20 degrees, we'll arrive off Puerto Plata on the north coast of the DR near dawn. I only hope we're well enough south of the Mushar Bank and its spike of exposed coral heads. I climb up the companionway feeling queasy, worried at the kick of steeper seas bearing down. How about some relief, I say to Philip, whose hands are locked on the wheel. It's all yours. I've got a new heading for Puerto Plata, I say. Are you sure you want to go there? Don't see how we can stay put, I say, not fully recognizing the consequences of entering the Dominican Republic loaded with cocaine. You're the skipper, but I would stay out rather than make a landfall anywhere. Philip has a point. Just like you always say, Skip, staying out in a gale is better than trying to fetch a harbor. But I don't think Stardust can push through the steep oncoming seas without breaking up. I can hear you talking to Hale and me, saying once a ship gets caught out in a blow, she needs to hove to under a Spitfire jib and try not to outsmart the pitch and roll. Stardust ain't your pirate's penny. She can't take this pounding to windward all night. As it is, I feel her tearing apart. I grab the wheel and swerve Stardust to the south. I look over my shoulder at the wake of Stardust's three hulls, stunned at their 10-foot height, standing over us like a mountain falling away and racing toward us simultaneously. Down below, I hear a crash like a rock tumbling down a mountain. I stick my head down the hatch and see our dining room table sheared from its bulkhead hinges. As clouds draw down the moon, the first sheet of rain rakes our decks. For all my looking into the maw of this wet ride, I don't see the full brunt of the storm breaking loose from the darkness. What I do see is a round light shooting off into the sky. The light plunges down, rises up, crisscrosses, disappears, rises again like a headlight on a runaway train, its hot brakes throwing sparks off its wheels. "Do you see that light?" I shout. Philip doesn't hear me as he checks the automatic bilge pump. "There's another boat out here," I say. "It's following us." "What?" Philip shouts over the rain. "Kill the running lights," I tell him. The swerving dial of light spins around the darkened stardust. As we skid into a trough, a voice booms over a megaphone. "Stardust, prepare for boarding." At first, I think this unseen warning springs from the omnidirectional voice of the Coast Guard. My spine stiffens for more instruction. Nothing comes. My body uncoils. I remember the only law on the Turks and Caicos is owned and operated by Jimmy Q. Through heavy plumes of rain, I take a long look and see the cruiser from Cockburn Harbor. I alter course to the east for what I hope is the northeast breaker of the Mouchard Bank. The water there drops from 100 fathoms to 2. I hope Stardust, with her shallow draft, can surf the edge of the shoals where the cruiser will turn back or capsize. The best I can bargain for is a game of hide-and-seek, where one boat races down slanted crags while the other rises on the crest. The blood pounding a hole in my chest tells me this is madness, but the hounds are near, Skip, and I have one chance to shake them before they shake me with a fury even greater than this storm. Get me the gun, I whisper to Philip. What are you going to do? Pray for a lucky shot. What's that supposed to mean? I'm going to try to hit their radar, my tongue clicking hard, my hands prickly hot. Philip grabs the gun from its holster, hands it to me, and takes the wheel. I lock my arms against the combing. As the light tracks behind Stardust, I catch a second sketchy profile of the Citadel and fire 6 bullets. I reload, fire again, trying to hit both the searchlight and the radar, but I'll settle for either one. A moment later, the light once again washes over the waves, no closer, no farther away. I think this is where trouble begins, Philip says, forcing a laugh. Not necessarily, I reply, still looking behind at the cruiser tracking us through the jag of colliding spray. Again, Philip sees a crooked chain of enormous white spokes throwing off buckets of foam as water pours over rocks and sucks back into blind holes the size of houses. You got a plan for negotiating this shoal? Philip asks. Yeah, I say. We're going to aim right for the reef, then slack off and run downwind, and you're going to stand on the bow and direct me, port or starboard. You mean you're turning us into shark bait? The cruiser pulls back from the first breaking waters of the Mouchard Reef. It's dwarfed by the waves as it bobs over crests, then yaws east, north, then shoots west behind the next wall of rain. I lose sight of the cruiser's searchlight. Instead, I stare into the swirling cascade ahead. The white water backslides around our hulls, pulling us toward the shoal. Philip clings to the lifeline as we stagger sideways, draw back, claw forward through spray. For one moment, with the blue-gray waves breaking over his head, Philip looks like a painted figurehead pegged to the bow, an apple-green face with tourmaline eyes. If he pops overboard, I think, I'll never find him in these seas. The hatch on the starboard hull just blew off. It's totally awash, Philip bellows, gyrating his arms like a windmill. Left or right? I shout, forgetting the nautical terms. He thumbs me to the right. I swing the boat to the south as we swoop down beside the ghostly heads of foam and leave them to port, nearly capsizing inside a wall of water. We did it, I shout. I don't see them behind us. My elation is short-lived, Skip. As the sea's white stub melts into gray, I see Stardust listing to starboard. Even off the wind, she hobbles. Philip clambers back to the cockpit and opens the stern lazarette for the manual bilge pump. 15-footers break over us. There's no way to stay even against such a mountain of water. Already, there have been 1,000 pounds of drag on the starboard hull. Philip stays forward for at least 30 minutes, pumping out the compartment, his harness snapped into the lifelines, a flashlight in his teeth. I fire up the engine and change course for Puerto Plata, but the new heading is nearly as brutal and unforgiving as the old one. With each broadside slammer, Stardust lifts her port hull out of the water, and the wind slaps hard and hobbles us like some red-eyed stray born of a deep scar. A random combination of pitching and rolling threatens to flip us over. Philip returns to the cockpit, drenched, woozy, frightened. What about the coke? I ask. Go check on it. What does it matter? Philip says. We're sinking, if you hadn't noticed. Go check on it. Philip disappears again for what seems like an hour. When he returns, he's too exhausted to stand. It's gone, he says. What do you mean? Take the wheel. I rush forward without a harness and jump into the starboard hull with the hatch blown off. I stand up to my thighs in seawater and fumble with a flashlight to find the sealed compartment. I don't trust what my eyes tell me. I feel with my fingers for the panel, but it's gone, and so are the taped bags of cocaine. They should be floating inside the hull, safe and dry, but they aren't there. All of them gone, washed out with a wave. How could it happen so fast? I crawl back to the cockpit, baffled by the loss. Listen, we'll be lucky to get back to land in one piece, Philip says consolingly. Besides, that coke was a death sentence if we got busted in the DR. $2 million worth, poof. So much for my retirement in St. Thomas. At least we're not floating face down in the soup, Philip says, a slow smile breaking. Not yet. I smile back until I hear a knock scraping against the hull. Did you hear that thud? Philip asks cautiously. It sounds like we hit bottom, but that's impossible, right? It's all good water here, I say, tasting the sweat running off my lips. Oh, Christ, the engine just conked out, Philip says. He turns over the ignition, but the gears won't engage. In the abrupt quiet of the boat's failed RPM, Philip rips up the engine hatch to find water seeping around the stuffing box. We must have hit something, Philip says. No way, I reply. I look over the transom. God damn it, I shout. The anchor line is wrapped around the prop. I look forward and see that the safety nets between the two outer hulls, where the anchor line had been tied off, have ripped away. One of us has to go overboard and cut the heavy braid nylon anchor line tangled around the shaft and prop. With luck, neither are bent, and Philip can re-engage the engine. With one hull sloshed full, Stardust doesn't have enough steam to sail up and out of the troughs. The waves are stacked too close together. Trying to cut a line underneath a moving boat in murderous seas is at best crazy. Philip's a master diver, but how can I ask him to volunteer for such a dive? How can I afford not to? I slide off the hatch and bathe every inch of the engine with my flashlight. I see water trickling through the stuffing box, but I also see something Philip doesn't see. One of the engine mounts has busted loose. It's no use going overboard, I say to Philip, my throat cinched down so tight I can hardly breathe. When the anchor line wrapped around the prop, it must have sheared the engine off her mounts. She's out of alignment. No way she's going to run. All we can do is get the bilge pump down there, try to stay even. Let me see, Philip says, taking a long look inside the engine's cavity, while Stardust rolls down the waves, some charging toward her, some boiling beneath, others smacking her abeam. With a listing starboard hull, no engine, and the wind tearing the head off of every wave, we list on a very slim margin. But we have to make ground skip, or I know we're going to die out there. I close the engine hatch and take the wheel while Philip goes forward, hand over hand, to raise the mainsail all the way up the hoist. I spin the wheel and bring her up into the wind. From the cabin top, I winch the furl out of the jib and swing the boat off wind. Stardust slams through the next wave with more muscle, but still, with all rags flying, the starboard hull drags us farther south than east. 3 hours later, the walls of rain close down around us, still running with lights off. I worry about broaching from a cross-hit rogue wave. I figure we're 35 miles off the DR between Puerto Plata and Haiti, with no good ports of entry and no way to sail upwind. I slow every movement down to make sure I don't lose grip. Philip delivers the less than cheering news that the batteries are nearly flat. Soon, none of Stardust's navigational equipment, lights, or refrigeration will work. In a few more hours, she'll be without any power, just a flagon of floating dark, with two sailors, eyeball to eyeball, with the thorns of this ticklish Spanish place. Any way I fillet the fish, we're screwed and tattooed, Skip, and I have no one to blame but myself for this long night. Stardust can't go forward, she can't go back, the wind's blowing barrels at us, our engine's dead. If you'd been there, Skip, maybe you could have figured something out, but I don't even know how to stop the drumbeat pounding my head, telling me I'm the king of all sailing fools for setting out against the trades. Then something curious and unreachable happens. I feel this lightness pouring into my face. I hear Hale saying, this night will pass and my boat will arrive in one piece. As bad as things are, Stardust will not crack up. She will not sink and I will not chum the waters of the thorny path. I'm not going to die under a mountain of back-swirling water. Do I imagine my brother's voice or do I really hear him say, you won't die tonight? Do I conjure him up out of the thorny path or do I only crave him? I can't say for sure. But after this, his invisible message, I sense a very different outcome. I lean into the ragged seas. I merge with my listing trimaran until I see the whole night unfolded around us as well as the next day. There's no other way to say this, Skip, but the dark and light of this crossing, not fit for man or beast, blends into some kind of homecoming, where there's no home except to go farther into the salt blur of my own wreckage. Just like now, with you in your bed, when the night could be day and the day night, stardust crabs towards the DR like a man, side-stroking out of a riptide. Slowly, impossibly, mercifully, our damaged boat is drawn out of her misery by the mountain air, lifting the easterly crush of the trades off the island's coast and off our bow. We feel too exhausted to nibble from the wet box of saltines lying between us, and yet Philip lifts his nose and catalogues the island smells, black earth, rotting mangoes, cows, charcoal, vanilla bean, cane standing in the field. Even with Hale's help out there, I'm still afraid our headsail will tear off the drum, not from a gust of wind, but from scooping water into its belly when the boat drops into a trough. I'm ready to cut it down should it falter and drag in the water, though if it comes to that, I can't imagine how Stardust can manage any headway with just the mainsail. At 6 a.m., the first light pricks swatches in the east, and we look there instead of toward the three silver sharks trailing aft like half-moons. Jesus Maria, we made it to the DR. Would you look at that mountain? Philip shouts like one of Columbus's men squirreled in a crow's nest. The coast looms up like the silhouette of a woman's body, a high scrim of rock floating behind a featherbrush swirl of clouds, the bights and headlands wrapped by a splice of surf and sand. After our detour in flat, Heeksote, Cockburn Harbor, I love the sight of so much mountain rising out of torn blue water. Now, all we have to do is figure out how to get off these seas, I say. I radio into the Dominican Republic, but no one, not even the military patrol, will come out in such high seas to lead us in, even though a double rainbow, wide enough for an armada, flumes a gateway. By mid-morning, we know Puerto Plata is still too far east, so we get radio directions for entering Luperon to the west, where the surf gushing between shoals looks like puffs of smoke fired from a cannon. We hug the beach in order to spot the entrance, the sharks still in tow, then we shoot down between reefs. Once in the channel's lee, dark blue water glasses over, men and women in skiffs paddle out to greet us. As we limp in under sail, one man throws me a bottle of local rum, a pure black strap that hits the back of my throat like a struck match. Another man, the color of ginger and cardamom, stands up in his precarious craft and waves us on in. Scrumptious, Philip says. Just leave me here till the next millennium. I feel relieved to be free of the cocaine, free to think through the next leg of my journey further south, free to consider how to make the next compass heading more inviting than the last. This may seem strange, Skip, but I feel like Hale has given me a second chance to redeem this delivery, and I aim to steer by his spirit voice for as long as I can. We've traveled to another world as clear and quiet as an alpine lake in Switzerland. In the lee of the mangroves, we watch egrets falling through tall, scraggly branches like confetti. In one quick tack between shoals, the blue diamond surge of waves shattering against the hulls is replaced by light green cocoa palm. We hear the heat oozing beneath leaves, the sun sucking moisture so the rain can fall again, the strum of insects on the prowl for pollen, and the flowering rot of things unclaimed. It's 4 a.m. I've been talking for hours, and now my watch is over. Ah, Skip, please tell me some part of you is here with me now. All I need is one nod, one finger wave from the helm of your hospital bed, your last boat. I promise you this. Before I'm through, I'm going to bring Hale home to you.
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email, and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by the Crime Wave.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.